The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets close near all-time highs. China calls off talks over the weekend. Pot stocks go haywire. Listener questions and our guest today is Christoph Zenk, Managing Director and Founder of SeasonX. All this and much more on episode number 580 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you, and as always, thanks for listening. I'm Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast and the co-host of DH Unplugged. Each and every Tuesday with John C. Dvorak. We're looking like we're going to have a pretty good show this week, so hopefully you'll join us live streaming with chat room on dhunplugged.com, 9 p.m. Tuesday evening. So make sure to be there and check out all that's going on with the news and how we go through it and look at it in quite a different way than we do normally. Kind of look at the edges and look at it from behind and try to understand exactly what's happening with the investing and business news of the week. Now, there's a lot going on. That's kind of cliche, but there is. There's a lot going on as the end of the year is now in sight. I wonder where the time has went here, but there's a few things that I wanted to get to this week in particular, a few things that we've been working on here for our clients, some research, and some things that have been on my mind. We're going to get to exactly what we're working on with regard to a very interesting study that we've been kind of crunching all the numbers on, a lot of data related to passive and active investing. And you know, this has been an area of great interest to many for some time, but really, what are the results of this? And while we're hearing all the benefits of cheap fees and low costs and why bother trying to outperform, what really is the bottom line here? So we wanted to really get down to this, look at the statistics, down to all the different areas of exactly what is the real truth behind the benefit of passive investing versus active investing. And we had some surprising results. Anyway, we're working on that. We'll get that out to you probably in the next quarterly commentary that we put out. So we'll make sure that we'll have that available to you. But we'll talk about that in a bit. I think we need to talk first of all about some of the recent market action, because I received just a boatload of emails from people, listeners wondering what is going on with the markets. Why are they going up? This is the general sense of what I got from these emails. Why are markets going up in the face of all this, the headwinds, the tariffs, the political nonsense that's happening? I think it's a really good question. And by the way, if you do have a question, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button and just ask away or comment, whatever you want to say. You want to tell me how good we're doing, how bad we're doing, how much you hate the show, how much you love the show, whatever it is. If you have a question about investing in particular, about a specific item related to your portfolio, your investing, just a question that comes up about, you know, economics, I'll be do my best to get it on the show or answer it personally for you. So here are some of my thoughts. I wrote down and I jotted down some of the things that are going on to answer this question, this general question that has come in about, you know, what's going on with markets? Why is it that they seem to go up no matter what, no matter what the news is, whether it's good, whether it's bad? You know, it just seems that U.S. markets are on fire and there's nothing that can stop them. That was, again, the gist of these emails. So I guess the first thing that we have to look at is, aside from a general uptrend, which is important, and there's plenty of liquidity still in the markets, we have a chase for return towards the end of the year. Aside from all that, there are a variety of narratives, several of them, that are playing out and are getting embedded in the news flow, in social media, in general discussions between investors. This is something that has been very powerful and is really shaping what's going on with markets. Now, that doesn't mean, I use the term narratives, doesn't mean that it's something false. It doesn't mean that it's propaganda. I'm just talking about the general tone, the argument, the conversation. This is all wrapped up into what I'm calling a narrative here. And if you remember, one of the first things that happened at the beginning of the year, and we talked about this so many times, that there was plenty of money, lots of money, I mean, enormous sums of money that were flowing into emerging markets and foreign stocks at the beginning of the year because everybody was talking about how they had an overly bullish view that the U.S. was expensive, so bullish on the rest of the world because the rest of the world was cheap. So they were kind of, I wouldn't say bearish on the U.S., but they were really bullish on non-U.S. equities. This played out towards the end of 2017 and into the first month or so of 2018. Everybody I talked to on the institutional side was talking about how, you know, you really need to underweight the U.S. equity exposure in your portfolio, and you need to really start to really think about overweighting the emerging markets, which look just incredibly cheap on a relative basis, and non-U.S. stocks in general. So money poured in to equities that were outside the U.S., and what's happening now, that narrative has switched 180 degrees, complete U-turn here, where that money that poured into emerging markets because of how cheap they were, and now all of a sudden they got smacked hard due to all the factors we've talked about, the dollar rising, the fact that there is a slowdown generally being seen in areas around the world, tariffs, all these things that are going on. And the best place to be now, the narrative has changed dramatically to, well, it's clearly the U.S. for so many reasons. And all the talking heads are now on board with the U.S. economy and earnings strength discussions. They're talking about reallocating into U.S., even though we've seen consistent outflows from U.S. funds recently. However, there's much less on a relative basis of outflows in the U.S.-based equity funds than we're seeing with non-U.S. So it's a kind of a net positive. So that narrative has changed entirely from what we've seen just 8 months ago. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's saying, you know, U.S. is the best place to be. Oh, my gosh, I don't want to be invested anywhere else because what we're seeing is a slowdown, et cetera, and the U.S. is holding up really well. Buybacks. Buybacks are big. We have these consistent buy programs at work, and you can see this very clearly by watching the tape throughout the day. There's no question that when the market opens and we're in buyback, buybacks are in the, you know, billions of dollars on a daily basis. You see that there is a consistent amount of buying that goes on throughout the day, every single day. And with that, you have a bit of a, I use this term very, it concerns me, but I'll say it, a bit of a safety net under many of the stocks that have buybacks and big buybacks or announcing a buyback. Now, buybacks, it's interesting because while buybacks were really a major driver for the market thinking and confidence in the markets, probably from, well, for many years, but clearly 2015, 16, 17, somewhere in the end of 2017, buybacks started getting a little bit of a bad name for themselves. With all the money that was being generated from the savings on taxes, everybody was hoping for that companies would do a little bit more to help the economy. A little bit of a trickle down. But we've seen what they've done is really use a lot of it to enhance shareholder value. And that's the tagline for buybacks and dividend increases. So somewhere along the line, buybacks were no longer the big driver. However, buybacks are still a driver within the markets. And then we have the constant talk about the positive view on U.S. economic growth and direction. And what's interesting about this is I like to watch the Citibank Economic Surprise Index. And what I find very interesting is with all the talk in the recent months about the positive direction of U.S. economics, and there is no doubt that there is economic strength and growth. So let's just get that out. There's no question about that. I don't think anybody questions that, at least what we've seen, and probably for the foreseeable future, aside from my theory in the next couple of quarters, my concern about this pull forward effect that I've talked about. But putting that aside for a second, looking at the numbers today, it clearly shows that the U.S. is in a very good place. And again, contrasting that with what we're seeing around the world, the U.S. is a much better economic place to be right now. That's why the dollar is strong. One of the reasons that the dollar has so much strength, aside from the Fed increasing rates and rates going higher. The fact is that the economy in the U.S. is stronger. So let's just all agree on that. One of the things that really I find very interesting, though, is the Citibank Economic Surprise Index is near the lowest point that it has been in 2018. It dropped from a high of about plus 82 approximately at the beginning of this year, and is currently at a negative 5, meaning that the economic reports that are coming out are worse than expectations that are placed on by the economic analysts out there. And when you see the Citibank Economic Index consistently going lower, you have to think that there's going to be an adjustment to those numbers, and the realization is that the economy usually follows along from there. Because what we're seeing is that the reports on the downside are outpacing where analyst expectations are. And if you think about that just from an earnings standpoint, kind of switch over for a second. If analysts have a dollar earnings expectation and the company comes in at 90 cents, barring the discussion about extraneous items and GAAP versus non-GAAP, or maybe even, you know, forgetting about their outlook, they missed the number. And probably what's going to happen is analysts will downgrade that and stocks will adjust accordingly on that one piece of information. However, there is a chance that, of course, you have different outlook that may help things. Now, when you come to economics, when you look at economics, you're really just looking at one number. Because while there is no company looking at expectations and showing what their run rates are now, there are some things that fit into that over time, of course. You have more pieces of information between the next report and now when you could see a change in that number, and maybe it will be a little bit better in the future. But you have nobody really sitting out there, aside from the Fed, really trying to pump the markets or pump the idea that there's going to be a better outcome in the future. Or, and also with companies, they'll tell you that, well, we have a negative outlook for the next period, just like Facebook did. You don't really see that with the players that are involved in the economics. The Fed's not going to come out, and maybe they will, but they haven't. Oh, we're really dropping our numbers down significantly. We really see a concerning outlook for this or that. I mean, that's not their job. Their job is to keep economic growth stable or growing and confidence high. So now we have this narrative that we have the consistent talk about positive U.S. growth, and in particular, on a comparative basis with the rest of the world. So that's the next part. Now, again, we're talking about why are the markets holding up so well? There's another narrative out there that we have things priced in. And in particular, talking about tariffs and Fed rate hikes. Because, of course, we know, at least we've been taught and told over and over and over and over again, that the market's a forward discounting mechanism, right? That everything that is known out there is already priced into the markets. Therefore, if we see that there is a $200 billion tariff that is placed on China, and initially the thought is that, oh my gosh, that's really going to cause global problems and is going to hit back home one of these days, and markets do exactly the opposite, they move higher, the belief is that, well, markets are a forward discounting mechanism, and therefore the idea by the general populace that are investing in this believe that it's not a problem. The market believes that it is not a problem. In fact, you could say that the $200 billion of goods that are being tariffed 10% and then potentially moving up to 25% at the beginning of next year, the markets see that as a net positive for the U.S. I'm not sure how, but that's what the markets see. That's what the market says. It's all priced in. There's also the hope and the belief that I think along with this, that this trade skirmish, as Jamie Dimon called it this week. Did you hear that? Jamie Dimon said, it's not a trade war. It's a trade skirmish. It's a fluff up. I mean, think of whatever words you want to put in there. It's a trade dispute. It's a kerfuffle. Whatever you want to look at. Whatever you want to call it. It's a trade dispute. It's a trade war to a degree. You want to call it a skirmish? Maybe that softens it a little bit. Okay. But the belief is, and the narrative that is embedded well with investors right now, is that this whole trade skirmish will only be a negotiating tactic that's eventually going to benefit the U.S. Once again, another check mark. U.S. benefits. We also have the expectation that earnings will grow near double digits next quarter. And if you take everything aside, you put all of the things we just discussed, put it on one side of the sheet over there, on the right side. The fact is that earnings will trump all of this. Earnings growth, earnings momentum, earnings will be the thing that really drives stock prices. There's all these other things too. But if we have the idea and the belief and the facts that earnings are growing and will continue to grow, stock prices will follow along. Question is, how much? RPE ratios and discounting of that properly priced in. Well, again, we say the market's right. We're not going to argue with that. And we also have this idea that the midterm elections are raising the potential expectation that we may have more Democrats in Congress. This is a story that's been making the rounds recently, and that would continue to create gridlock. And markets like gridlock because you don't have any regulations or laws that can be put into place that may be detrimental to the financial system. Now, at the same time, let's all agree that we don't know what Congress has been doing lately anyway. Seems that executive action seems to be the current means of making law. So Congress has been kind of a lame establishment of late. Now, all these things, and there are plenty more of the things we could talk about here, are shaping the investment climate. Now, of course, let's not leave out the mega trend of passive investing. I think we have to probably bring that into the play of this discussion, as well as investing in the entire market over single stock issues has been something that has been seen as a real benefit. And more people are believing in this, acting on it, doing it. And that is obviously pushing money into the major markets. Finally, this trend following. And clearly, this idea of trend following has been and continues to attract funds to U.S. equities because the momentum is there. And investors, if you know anything about investing psychology, is that investors will go and find where the money is working best and put their money there. And hopefully that's going to benefit them. Now, not all of this is bad and not all of this is good either. It really all depends on how each of these factors play out over time. So I guess if each is proven true, if we go through the list and think about that, then that's one more benefit to the bullish argument. No question about that. On the other hand, if you really think about it for a second, if we start to see some kinks in the narratives, then the confidence in those narratives will basically wane. They'll start deconstructing. And you're also seeing some things like broadening of market participation, the recent rally. For some time, we've seen that investors were really relying on the biggest names in the markets to really do the heavy lifting. And recently, we've seen that that's not really happening. Those stocks like Netflix and Facebook and Google and Apple are disproportional weight in the indices, and those are really doing a major job at lifting those. But we've seen that many of these companies, you know, look at the Netflix, look at the chart there, Facebook, they're not really playing very well lately. Therefore, what's happening? Well, obviously, alternatives are being bought up, smaller companies or different companies aside from these, and we're showing better market breadth, which is a definite positive for markets. So to answer the question more clearly, at this time in history, there are more good reasons to buy stocks by most accounts, even as there are headwinds that appear to say otherwise. Confidence is high. These narratives are really shaping things. And until something changes material, I don't think we should expect a change for market sentiment or direction. But there is one important caveat to this. The change can happen in an instant for any reason. We've seen it before. We'll see it again. Why? There could be that there's a recognition that the trade disputes or the war, the kerfuffle, actually isn't as negligible on earnings and economics as many had thought. I guess that could be one thing. Or maybe this weekend's announcement that China's walking away from these low-level talks. They're just saying, screw you. We're not dealing with it. I mean, maybe that's something. Maybe that's going to be a trigger. Or maybe companies provide a different outlook in their next earnings about the future and how earnings are impacted by these tariffs. We've seen several companies already announce the tariffs are, it's the new weather, right? Weather affected our earnings. That's why, tariffs are the new blame for outward guidance. Any one of these can really activate a change in sentiment. So as investors, our job is to pick up on the prompts and act accordingly for both an offensive and a defensive positioning of our portfolios. I mean, think about it this way, I guess. You have a football team, and that football team, they have a great winning streak. And they do this with a superb current lineup and a playbook, and they've been doing this for some time. However, if something changes dramatically, it could be a key player's injury, weather changes that they're not used to, confidence within the team for some reason drops, a rule change, a coach change. There's a lot of things that can happen there. Then they may no longer be able to win. They may no longer have what it takes to keep their solid win-loss ratio. So a lot of things can change. A lot of things can all of a sudden be the catalyst for why we're seeing a big move in a direction that is not what we like for markets. And any of these one things could be that activation, that trigger for it. So just getting around to answering that, I put some time into thinking about what was the reasons that really are driving things right now to help you understand. And the other thing is, remember, one of the things you want to look at here is not what your personal overlays are and beliefs are in the intermediate term. Long term, those are fine. If you have a thesis on why something's going to do something, for example, you believe that, I believe that pot stocks are going to be the next, thing because there's this legalization and we're going to see recreational use across Canada and it's probably going to trickle down to the U.S. A lot more growing is going to be required. Medical use are going to increase, blah, 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 blah. Well, long term, you may say that that's a place to be. But if you start to think about, I don't like the markets because I'm seeing all these negative things that go on with geopolitics and all this. And in the short run, you're wrong. Watch the market as a better place to look at this. Watch trend, watch charts, understand what's happening, understand the fundamentals of all this that can really debunk your thesis that you're looking at possibly the wrong areas of the market, the wrong drivers of market conditions, in order to be more profitable and to have your portfolio perform better. So just to make sure you're clear about that, there's a lot of things that go into this, but one of the things you have to be very aware is not to be overconfident in your particular beliefs if the market's doing something different. And vice versa, of course. Now, speaking of win-loss ratios, let's talk how investors can benefit on this idea of seasonal trends. So I want to bring in this particular guest from SeasonX, and we have I think talk about the whole idea of seasonal and seasonality. And after we talk with Christoph, we'll get some interesting listener questions and something we have been working on that you'll find really interesting regarding this whole passive and active investing argument. And let's get right to a discussion with our guest. That's Christoph Zenk. And he is he's a managing director and founder of SeasonX. Now, if you recall, we had someone on from SeasonX a few months back. And at that time, we were talking about this whole idea of seasonality and event-driven strategies. And we talked about, if you remember, we talked about the idea of the World Cup as an example and how that has an impact on the countries that actually have the World Cup. So this time we're going to talk a little bit about something different, something we teased you about in the last time because they were just still, I think, building it. With that, Christoph, how are you?
I'm fine so far. Thanks for being on the show with you.
Yeah, all the way from Vienna, one of my favorite cities in the world.
Great to hear.
Yeah.
But by the way, it's 5:30 here p.m. at the moment.
Oh, okay. There you go. So here, I want to talk about some of the things that you're doing because when we had talked last to your partner, we had talked about the idea that you were coming out with an app. And the app would be available for website use where you could find seasonality trends in a variety of things. But let's start with the whole idea of seasonality. And why is that important to you? And what is the use case of it for investors?
Yeah, sure. Well, seasonality, as far as we go there, is there are recurring patterns every year which occur for different reasons, of course. And people are used to that. Like they know that something happens over the year. But what they don't see in the first look is that happens for single stocks as for commodities or currencies. And my partner figured out an algorithm to figure out an easy way to identify them and then to evaluate them. Because it's something to know that there is a pattern, but there's another approach to really see it and have the ability to directly look at certain stocks, which are maybe your favorite ones, just to figure out if you have the right timing to know where's a high or low over the year, for example.
Now, in some of the seasonality algorithms and calculations that I've looked at historically, one of the things that I've noticed is that they use kind of this whole idea of, okay, there is a seasonal trend in this direction. The bias is in this or that direction, up or down, let's say. But they don't give you the depth. They don't give you necessarily, well, is it a really, you know, it's a negative time, but let me rephrase that. It's a good time or a bad time. Now, what I mean by that is sometimes are better to be invested in a particular stock or an index or a currency, and sometimes it's not as good. Whereas the seasonality that I've seen is just tells you, well, the bias is, it could be not as good as other times. Whereas yours seems to be a little bit more in the charts that you put up and the seasonal analysis that you put up is much more of a kind of a look at percentage gains and losses, right?
It's a little bit more sophisticated, I would say, because that just knowing where it goes up or down is the one thing, but we wanted to enable any user to really dig into the seasonality, just not only getting like a signal, but really getting a feedback where it could dig deeper and see if how stable a pattern is, for example, how often it happens, if there were years which didn't work out, for example. So like if you know where the seasonality comes from, then the pattern usually is very strong. But if you don't know it, you need an indicator if it's strong or not. And that's where we go to. It not only gives you back a graph which shows you where like there's an upwards trend, for example, but you can really identify and then evaluate it in depth, for example.
So I'm looking at, I pulled the chart off the off of your app or the website yesterday, and it was Apple. I don't know if you have this up on your screen, but I looked at Apple and I said, wow, look at that. I looked at a variety of different ones, but Apple has a strong tendency from about now through, I would say, the first 2 weeks of October to be a real negative return. And that's over the total historical time period that I looked at. Now, there's a couple times it was up, a couple times down, but it looked like a pretty strong signal from your chart. Am I correct in looking at that this way?
It could be correct. I haven't it opened yet, but there are things where you have to really take care of, but especially when you come to technology trends, stocks which most of the time go up, which is like for Facebook, Google, or others, for example. In that case, you have to dig a little bit deeper, but basically, the idea is giving any user the chance to directly pick the stock of your choice. Like in your case, it would be Apple. And it's very easy to figure out how the trend could look like based on the historical data. And that's like something you can put into your decision on when to buy or sell, for example.
And again, for Apple, I used about a 30-year time period in the data. So that's a lot of quality data in there. It's not just a one-year period. And what's interesting to note is that you can actually, like you said, people have to try it. You'll tell them how to get, to take a look at this. But it's a cool dashboard. That's what I like about it because it tells you, like you said, outlier years that it didn't work out, why it was, maybe some of the years that it was really good in this and maybe overrode some of the other years and maybe why it looked this way. And you can take what I think the coolest part of it was, by the way, and is the cursor where you can tap on an area in a chart, drag it to another area. So you have two different dates that are now anchored, and it will tell you statistically your probabilities of what happened. Well, historically, of course, but historically what the probabilities were. That's a really cool feature.
That's right. But because our approach was like, it should be easy. It should be understandable. You could put in directly the dates or just play around with the cursor, for example. And it's like the first version was built for professionals. But at the same time, we wanted everybody to be able to use it. And we wanted to make it feel that nice that you would really like dig deeper, try out, figure out where like changes come from, and maybe then try to figure out why certain years didn't work out. And I think it's really fast. Like you have to imagine that it's a real-time backtesting more or less. So anybody who has no mathematical skills would think like it's really hard to predict stuff like that. But within the application and the dashboard, you get all the numbers in like two clicks. And I think that's a pretty big plus for the application itself. So like it doesn't cost you a lot of time to analyze any of your stocks, which you are maybe trading, for example.
Right. And you're covering even some cryptocurrencies, you're covering stocks, you're covering ETFs, you're covering indices, currencies, all this stuff. It's really cool. But one of the questions I had when I was looking at this is, so if we believe that seasonality or seasonal trends are there for some reason, whatever the reason is, okay, isn't there a case to be said that once that seasonality is discovered, it kind of doesn't work anymore?
Like that question comes up quite often, but there are seasonal trends which are there since like the 80s, for example. Like some sayings, for example, sell in May and go away, they are known since years. Still, they are existing. And when it comes down to single stocks or currencies, for example, there's so much volume in the market that only seasonality, like it doesn't disappear directly. Not everybody is like pulling this out and not everybody is trading on that. So until now, like the seasonalities we have discovered and which we are trying out and publishing, they're still there. And sometimes they shift, that's true, because if people know something, then they jump in earlier maybe. But that's the only thing that happens. Like it only shifts. In the perfect market, there wouldn't be any seasonality. You would like have a straight line. But we are not in a perfect market. And there are enough reasons for those seasonal trends.
So what are the best setups that you have found on this? Obviously, we could just look at a chart and say, okay, well, that goes up really nicely. Let's say, you know, during the months of November through December, and maybe we look at, for example, midterm election years and we scoot out everything else. I mean, what are some of the setups that you have found, whether it's broad-based or whether it's individual stock-based, that really stand out to you?
I was more focusing on single stocks, to be honest, because that's where I want to dig into. Like I find a seasonality and I try to figure out where it comes from. And as soon as I find a reason, or at least I think that I found a reason, I consider that pattern to be really stable. And that's what we're doing since years now. And we try to identify signals over the whole year with the idea of like jumping into a stock, like then leaving it and jumping to the next one. And over that, we can multiply the returns. And I like to try different things out. And of course, we publish stories around that because not everybody who would use the application would know where seasonality comes from, but it's something we try to give back to the community. So we write newsletters for them to describe where they come from, what the reasons could be. And the feedback is great on that.
So just as a point of reference, and this may not go back 30 years, but this Apple one, so you talk about trying to find a reason, right? So I started thinking about that without you saying that before. I didn't realize you were going to say that. But I'm like, okay, well, why does Apple have this seasonal bias to the downside from the end of, let's call it the end of September, mid-September, end of September, down? And I thought, well, maybe it has to do with some of the iPhone launch dates or the, you know, the launch dates of various components they have that is kind of a build-up into it and then to sell the news concept. The only thing I could come up with.
Like it can be keynotes, for example. It can be quarterly reports, which surprise most of the time. Like there can be different reasons. During this summer, there have been a lot of surprises, honestly. In the case of Apple, you will probably have to dig deeper. Apple is something where I don't go into it because there's so many people have an eye on that. So I pick stocks which are not traded that much, which are not that known, where I think I can find a reason more easier. Mm. Like Apple is a big one. And if you would use the app right now, for example, just as a hint, you could activate Detrended as a feature.
Oh, this is important. This is important. This is important because it's a question I have here. It's called, so there's a button you can press on the chart called Detrender. And to be very honest with you, your definition says, use this to activate the Detrender to get rid of certain trends, whatever. I'm thinking, that's not a definition. That just says what to do. Just a little something from this side of the equation, you probably could use a better definition of what that is.
You are totally right because I see that pop up too, and it's one of the most reasonable questions people are asking. What exactly is Detrended? And it's a really important feature within the application, but not everybody understands how to use it. And to give you a feedback on that, if you would normally have a seasonal trend, it always starts at 100% and shows you the change over time. And the chart would end at, let's say, in the case of Apple, it would end at 120%. If you would activate Detrended, it would recalculate that chart, and it would start and end at 100% to give you more insights to the seasonality. You see the same chart, but it's visualized in a different way.
So it bases it at 100 then?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you can identify seasonal trends better than in others. It's especially important for Apple, Facebook, and others, which are like going up always, but they do have trends which you wouldn't see in between.
I like that. A seasonal guy saying, Apple, yeah, it goes up always.
Okay.
I like that.
Over years, for example.
Yeah, but the Apple, I used the Detrender, and it clearly showed a much greater propensity to move lower during, it's three separate periods. One of them is, we'll call this, let's see where I am here, mid-May through
exactly.
June. And then another one in September, end of September, or second week of September into, let's call it the second week of October. And then we have another one that it moves, it kind of ramps back up. And we'll call it when it starts rolling. I'll use that as sort of, I guess that would be at the end of November into the mid part of December.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Like now you're, as a seasonal chart, you are going deeper already. But if you would see Apple as a normal stock without the seasonal trends, you would like see it as a straight line more or less. But in that case, you're right. There are three downside trends in Apple too. And it will be interesting if that goes the same direction this year.
Yeah. So you're using what? Using daily returns for this?
Exactly. End of day date is what we are using in the web application. On Bloomberg and Thomson Reuters, which is more for the professional stuff, there we use tick-based data.
Wow. Why would you use tick-based data for seasonality trends that are over periods? I mean, you're doing like tick-based so you can find day trading ideas?
Exactly. In the other version, which is only available in Bloomberg and Thomson Reuters, you can create intraday seasonal charts, which, like, they, of course, they get calculated different, and there we need different information. And in that case, we use more data. In the web version, we are focusing mainly on the annual seasonality.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine trying to trade against, yes, if you have the desire to work, on a Thursday in September, show me the tick data for each day and what the seasonality is under that, and try to trade against that, that would seem, I would say, difficult at best. That's personally what I would think.
Yeah. But. Well, if you would go for gold, for example, and you would pick up the intraday chart for the last 10 years, then you would directly see that the best time to buy gold would be around 10 a.m., for example. But that's like a very long range of time. And it's very specific. And most of the users we talk to are focusing on the annual seasonality.
Right, exactly. So tell me this, you know, when people come into this, and this is a great discussion when I'm talking about Apple here, how do people work with this when they have a certain bias, whether it's long or short or some other bias on a name, and they're looking at this trying to say, okay, yeah, I know it's going to go down and therefore I'm going to use this, you know, to make sure they don't get involved and entangled in their biases when looking at these charts?
Yeah, that's a main problem in trading anyways. But what we try to focus on is, like, we purely put out all the emotions. It's just statistics. It's just math. You can whether use it or not. Some people do believe it, but they do face a problem if they stick to a brand or they don't want to get out of it. We are like seasonalities or like season X itself is there is no emotions. It's calculations and you can use it for decisions or not. I would recommend it, but it's always up to the trader himself.
And then also, I guess then we have to ask what are the pitfalls? What do seasonal charts not tell us that we need to be aware of? And when we're working with this, not just say, oh, that looks good, and just take that trade.
If you would really directly trade on that, you should always have a second or third source which you would add to that, because this is historical data which is telling you what happened in the past. It can't be more like that. We do predict the future, of course, but if you have insights, if you see there's a change in the market or you do know something especially is happening, then you should trust a second source too. Like, in my opinion, if you use a seasonal chart, and if you know the stock works the same as it did the 10 years before, then you can trust it. If the year turned out to be different, then I would try to figure out something new.
Mm, interesting. So this is available. This is out now, right? And are you continually adding different securities?
We have now around 12,000 assets, adding more and more. But where we are going to now is we're adding features. Because the heavy users we have, they are giving us great feedback. And from their point of view, we have to focus on their needs. And that's what we're doing. And it's coming from automatic screening for our seasonalities, for example. It's getting in the direction of...
I'm glad you brought that up. No, because I was thinking, is there a best ideas button here? Is there automatically screen for stocks that have the best opportunity for the month of October, let's say, going into October, or some other screening, because otherwise you got to kind of flip through charts one by one, right?
Exactly. Well, right now, for example, our users, they are showing their own portfolio, then they are trying to figure out when there would be the best time to sell, hold, whatsoever. And it's hard for them to manage that. And of course, they are seeking for some kind of feature where they could screen their portfolio, screen single stocks and stuff like that. And that's one of the main features we're working on right now. And I don't have a timeline for that, but that's heavy mathematics. But it will be on by the end of this year or early next year.
Thank you for using the word mathematics and not algos or algorithms.
Yeah, of course.
I appreciate that. Or AI. That's another one, right?
Yeah. Not yet, but it's something like we have to dig in that too. But for me, it's math, and we'll see how much it evolves over time.
You know, just a side note, algos are just math. They're just packaged mathematics. They're just a packaged mathematical equation.
That's true.
That's all it is, right? So this is great. So people can go over to SeasonX, which is the word season with an AX on it on the end, .co, not .com, .co. And is there, I honestly don't know this. I know that you gave me a trial to check out and look at this. And this is not a setup, but is there a trial for people? Can they check this out? How does this work?
Thing is, as soon as you get on the web application itself, there is like, I would say 10 to 20 free patterns you could directly investigate and, okay. and try to figure out if it works for you. If you then at some point want to have more, you can register. And as soon as you are going for the full version with the credit card, you again have 3 free days and you can quit service at any time. And afterwards, you have to pay. So whoever wants to dig into that, give it a try. And if you don't like it, just stop using it. If you like it, any feedback is welcome. And every new user is welcome, of course, too.
Is there any, just get back to seasonal trends for a second. Is there any use of trying to look at seasonal trends with economics? Does that work?
That's a question for Dimitri, to be honest, like because that goes out of the application itself.
Right.
He tries to figure out stuff like that, and that's besides normal functions, but of course they exist too.
Right, good stuff. Christoph Zenk from SeasonX.co.co, Managing Director and Founder. I appreciate you spending some time with us. Great stuff, really interesting. You know what I'll do? I'll post a couple of charts up there on the show notes so people can check out what this looks like.
Sounds great to me.
Right.
And if you want to use that, go to the share button because at any time, if you find a pattern, you can directly share it.
Share, perfect. Very good. I'll do that. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Always trying to find new and interesting ideas, guests that could really bring something to the table here. And I think Christoph did just that. So really interesting stuff. I personally like to take a little bit more of a look in the whole idea of seasonal analysis, seasonality. We know that there's something there. And maybe this is a good tool to actually uncover some great ideas. We'll see how this Apple idea plays out, which we posted a screenshot of that seasonal trend on the show notes for this episode number 580. Okay, so we have some listener questions. I want to mention. So we all know that there has been a really significant move towards, and almost a movement towards passive investing. The idea that, well, why would you try to beat an index by utilizing an active manager that's going to basically just try to emulate that index and pay, you know, a ridiculous fee to do so, which I'll go along with that. At the same time, we also know that this has been gaining strength through one of the best bull market runs in history. So when it comes to equities, okay, you know, it makes sense that for the most part, active managers we have seen at least have performed or somewhat underperformed. But even if you take their extra amount of risk they need to take in order to perform at the levels of the index, therefore they're taking more risk because they have to make up for their fee. Is it worth it? And the same thing with fixed income is a big discussion. Now, you know, the way we invest here for our global allocations, also for Investology, is that we try to look for ETFs for certain areas that are less efficient. We use ETFs for more areas that are more efficient. I'll turn that around. ETFs for areas that are more efficient, because why not? Again, why try to beat the index and pay extraneous fees when it's not necessary? However, at the same time, we use very low-cost active mutual funds for those areas that are less efficient. We really wanted to revitalize a study that we did some time ago with a lot more data inputs, a lot more time, and utilizing especially this particular run, the last, let's say, 10 years, that were a very good way to now try to benefit the ETF side of the argument, in that the ETF passive side, and look at the actual performance comparison of passive versus active. Passive being an ETF that emulates a particular interest index at a low cost, and active that is, you know, in the same spectrum of category of a passive fund or an index. So it's whether it's, let's say, long-term corporate bonds or short-term low-duration bonds, and take a look at really what that is. We'll have that analysis for you. I think you're going to be a little bit surprised at the actual numbers. I was a little bit surprised in some of these. But very, very interesting. So we'll have that for you and then kind of go through some of the statistical, the bottom line of what this all means and try to give you a very good analysis, but more so a summary that shows, you know, what the performance attributes are and issues related to this and some of the potholes that are involved in this as well when you're looking at this. But we'll have that for you probably in the next quarterly that comes out at the end of this month or so, a couple of weeks after the end of the month. All right, we have some listener questions. Steve Atora, he had written in, and he says, hey, there seems to be a mantra that the tax cuts are a one-time thing. And yes, the large earnings growth we are seeing will not be repeated once the year is over and comps catch up. But what about margins? These are better permanently and allow companies to invest either in the business of their stock or their stock, both good for shareholders. This, to me, improves business outlook going forward. Steve, I don't really have any argument necessarily. I do agree that, yes, it's going to be much harder for earnings comp and earnings growth to stand up to what we saw after the tax cuts. There's no question about that. Margins, yes, will be better. However, there are more things that go into the margin discussion. While they'll be bettered by the fact that taxes are lower and they don't have to have that as a major expense line, there are other things that go into that. And the question is going to be, how much of these tariffs, how much of the price increases in goods can be passed down, or how much will have to be absorbed? If we know by past history, companies will pass those on eventually. Maybe not immediately. So that's the one kink in your argument there. If we just look solely at the tax cuts, I'll agree with you. But I think there are more inputs that go into this that we have to address. Let's see here. Asaf Saitan, he wrote in. He says, hey, Andrew, I'm a young intern in a portfolio management company from Israel. I started listening to you about 2 years ago after I heard you on Frank's podcast, and I really appreciate it since. I would like to give you more compliments, but this is the Ask Andrew questions. Can you share your information sources, websites, podcasts, newsletter? And second, in your last podcast, you said the market reacted good news and prefer to look away from bad ones. So I think let's get to the first part of this first, or the second part. I think we just answered some of that about the looking at good news versus bad news, the narratives that are out there. I think that we're in an uptrend, and generally speaking, there is a glass half full or totally full versus glass half empty kind of discussion that's going on and that's permeating investors right now. And I think that is significantly helping to ward off any of the negative bias that may be approaching from some of the things that are out there. So it is... And maybe not so that, you know, markets like good news and they ignore bad news. Markets are just, you know, doing their thing. Maybe they're ignoring news entirely. But it does seem when the news comes out on the good side that they really start to move things up, where on the negative side, they think it's kind of temporary. The other question you have is information sources. I mean, we use a lot of information sources. Y charts, Bloomberg, Reuters, Morningstar, internal data that we gather and crunch from a variety of sources. Of course, all the regular periodicals. But, you know, I'll tell you at the same time, some of the sources that we have, we much prefer the data-driven sources because some of the other ones, when you start to look at them, when you have analysis, it gets kind of questionable. One of the sources I really like for daily information and analysis is briefing.com. Awesome, awesome site. Particularly if you could pony up a few bucks to pay for the briefing trader. I got to tell you something. Even if you do it for 1 month, you're going to be like, wow. Oh my, there is a lot there. And the briefing trader side where they're talking about their entries and exits, why this, why that, when an earnings notice comes out from a company, the quick analysis of it, really great stuff. All right, let's see. Stephen Y writes in. He says, "Hi, Andrew. Thanks for doing the podcast for 10 plus years. My pleasure. You provide lots of information and education materials in these shows. Appreciate it and keep up your good work. Just a question. When thinking you had been doing this for so long, why do trading firms or individuals want to present their trades on YouTube?" That's a good question. "Given just a small number of viewers, these audio or video can hardly influence anything that you get some membership registration. Not sure if this is viable business model other than passionate. What do you think?" Listen, you know, it's interesting because when you're looking at marketing or information or media channels, any of the above, I mean, YouTube has to be brought into it. And YouTube is the place if you want to do video instruction. And a lot of places, we do, for example, we have a YouTube channel for trigger charts. Why? Well, trigger chart is a visual experience. When you want to understand what's happening with technical analysis, you look at charts. If I was to try to explain this to you, either in a very longhand instructional type of text and pictures, it still doesn't grab you as well as it does if you see it right on your screen. Now, why do some of these places put their trades up and who knows what trades they're doing? Are they really just showing you their best trades? I don't know. But it's just a very easy way to publish. The platform makes it very easy for anyone, as you have seen by the crazy videos you see out there, for anyone to become a publisher. And for the most part, it's free. YouTube gets the money on you for any advertisements. You may get a couple of pennies here and there. But generally speaking, I guess it's just to have a place that you can put videos and then repurpose them. Again, I mean, it's on our page over on triggercharts.com. There's a whole host of videos on there that we bring right in from YouTube. It's just an easy place and a great repository. Plus, I don't have to have my own video streaming servers. So it may not be necessarily a business model more than it is just a place to have a free server, a video streaming server. Let's see. And the last one I have is a long one here that I thought I'd answer from Christoph K here. He says, "Hi, Andrew. Today I did a monthly review of my investment accounts. Like many people, I have a 401k and a non-tax-exempt individual account. Fidelity is asking me for a while to set up exit strategies for my investments. I did that some time ago for individual stocks, but not for ETFs and funds. My question, do you recommend to have an exit strategy for funds and ETFs, and how should I look? What should it look like?" Well, yes, of course you need an exit strategy. I mean, you need to have a strategy that is essentially going to be for entries and exits depending on your time frame, your risk, and what your goals are. So if your goals are just to invest for the long haul, maybe you don't need one. But if you're doing any kind of, whether it's a rotation or it's a trading strategy or anything that's less than that, you should have specific price points that you look at. Now, one of the problems you have, though, is with ETFs, for the most part, if they're not actively traded with high volume, you can get caught with a really bad print on your stop price if you put stops on. So what I would do for you with that is find somewhere you can put alerts in, whatever the trading platform is. Put a price alert in. When it hits that price, that's when you sell. So use that as your exit strategy. You also had asked me about, do I recommend any exit strategies for my 401k investments? Mine are all large funds. That's my employer. That's all that my employer offers. First of all, I would talk to my employer about offering other things like maybe some fixed income, maybe some alternatives like commodities, maybe even alternative investments. And you should be more diversified, I would think. But exits for that, a little bit different because your time horizon is a little bit longer. Good diversification is what you need there, more importantly. Also, do you recommend to have one for individual stocks? Some time ago, I got bumped out of NVIDIA after drop below my trailing stop, but it recovered quickly. And of course, I was out. Again, you can use this. One of the ways people ask me, what do I do? I want to, you know, protect myself, but yet I don't want to be out. Sell half the position. Sell 30% of the position. You don't have to sell all the position. And if a stock that you really like, you don't have to really, you know, take it down pretty low, maybe towards your entry point or a little bit lower than that, probably 7% below your entry point, give or take a little bit, depending on the volatility of that particular stock. But if it's something that you really believe in long term, you can, you know, you have to look at this a bit of a on a weekly chart rather than just a daily or a 30-minute chart. Understand your time frame is probably one of the most important things. And that's why, you know, and we talked about this investology. When we set up the whole parameters of how to determine what portfolio risk factors you should be in when you invest with us at investology.com, one of the things is time horizon. That goes into the whole analysis of what your portfolio should look like. Think about your time horizon. Step back, get away from the screen, get away from the books, get away from the news. Sit down and think about for a second, what's my time horizon? Whether it's a time horizon for you personally or for maybe for the individual position. Am I thinking this is going to be a real winner over time and I'm willing to take the risk and hold this for some time? Well, then you may not have a stop on that. Maybe you also reduce your position sizing so it doesn't freak you out if the thing drops. So you have to balance all that together. All right. That ends that. I think that's all the questions we have for this show, all the time we have for this show. Again, just go over to Ask Andrew on the DisciplinedInvestor.com page up top right. Click the button. Just ask the question. Anything you want to ask is fair game. Anything you want to say. And I appreciate your, listen, I appreciate everything you say. We are a community. We are friends. We are a family. That's how I look at it. That's why I do this. That's why I do this regularly. Hardly miss a week unless something major happens over the last 10 or 11 years. So thanks for being there for me. I appreciate it. Anything you need from me, just let me know. Until next week, I bid you adieu. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.